morning. Go ahead and be seated. All right, our matter of today, Virgin Valley Water District versus Paradise Canyon. Are we ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Come on. Did you want to reserve any time?
Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Joe Reynolds, and I represent the appellant Virgin Valley Water District. Waters of the Virgin River flowing through Mesquite, Nevada belong to the public and the people of the state of Nevada. The Virgin Valley Water District was created by the Nevada legislature and is overseen by a 5-member elected board who are elected directly by the residents of Mesquite and entrusted to manage and protect those waters for the benefit of the public and the common good, including setting rates for the use of those waters. In this case, the district court set aside the rate-making decision of the board, substituted its own judgment and that of a jury for the board, and awarded Paradise Canyon, a private golf course, an unqualified right to the waters of the Virgin River in perpetuity without ever having to demonstrate beneficial use and at a rate 75% below the Southern Nevada market. At the center of this case is the meaning of a 5-page lease agreement, but what the district court decided in its pretrial rulings is not what the lease provided, it is not what Nevada law allows. In the jury trial that followed those rulings was filled with error, and we're asking this court to reverse and remand this case. There are 10 issues set forth in our opening brief. They are interwoven, but each one of those issues provides a basis for this court to reverse. These issues can be broken down into pretrial summary judgment rulings by the district court, the admission of evidence and evidentiary rulings, and procedures and the conduct of the trial itself. Issues of Nevada law, constitutional interpretation, and contract interpretation are reviewed by this court de novo, and we're going to start with those in my presentation with those first. The question before this court is, was the water district acting within its statutory authority when it set the lease rate in this case? And the answer to that question is yes. That authority is spelled out in Nevada law in the water district's governing charter. This court has held recently in Southwest Gas Corp versus PUCN that rate setting is not a judicial branch function. It's a legislative function. And here the legislature expressly granted the ability and the authority of to the board to set rates over waters in the Virgin Valley. In other words, setting water rates, even for leases, is a core responsibility of the board. Those duties are set forth expressly in Nevada law in the enabling charter of the board, which states the authority of the board is to fix, establish, and adjust water rates, set classes of water rates, terms and conditions for leasing and using water to any public or private entity, to perform any acts necessary or convenient or proper for the performance of any agreement, to maximize the use of water resources for the common benefit.
So, Mr. Reynolds, I understand that one of your arguments is that that separation of powers prevented the district court from having jurisdiction, but isn't it true that the enabling statute provides for litigation in the district court?
Justice Bell, yes. The charter does allow the district to be sued. But our argument isn't that we can't be sued, but it's that the rate-setting authority can't be substituted by the district court or by a jury. And that's what occurred in this case, in that when a public body, which acts within the four corners of its sovereignty in its express statutory duties, can't contract those duties away. And it is that rate-setting function that we're arguing is improper and violated the separation of powers by overruling and setting aside a decision that the board made to set the water rate and substituting a jury decision for what that rate should be. Not only is the board's authority to set the rate set forth in the statute, but it's also expressly reserved in the lease agreement and the issue itself. This court is contract 101, that the plain language of a lease controls. In the express provisions within the lease agreement say repeatedly that the board is to set the rate in its sole and absolute discretion. Sole means only, absolute means final. So not only does the board have the authority in its enabling charter, but also reserved that authority expressly in the lease at issue. Moreover, the exercise of that discretion by the board in this case was reasonable and rational. The board set the new water rate at approximately $1,100 for Paradise Canyon. The rate being paid by the Southern Nevada Water Authority was a little bit over $1,200. There was a rational basis for what the board decided to do in setting this new water rate after the expiration of the initial 8-year term of the lease.
Compounding the, what that language in the lease that says on a perpetual basis means, because there's quite a bit of disagreement on that particular point.
Your Honor, one of our issues in compounding the error in this case is the finding by the district court in pretrial rulings that the golf course had a unqualified right to lease in perpetuity. The phrase perpetual basis must be read in conjunction with the phrase right of first refusal. The phrase right of first refusal appears 19 times in the lease agreement itself, and perpetual basis is in the same sentence as the right of first refusal. The intent of the language in the lease agreement and the intent of the board was that Paradise Canyon can maintain a right of first refusal on a future offering of the water at a rate set by the board on a perpetual basis if they do not otherwise breach the lease. It is not that they get a right to renew the lease on a perpetual basis.
Can you put in context for me that the district court had indicated its impression of the right of first refusal, so-called right of first refusal? Can you just comment?
We believe the district court misread and misapplied the entire lease agreement and overlooked of what the meaning of a right of first refusal is. What that meant was that Paradise Canyon is first in line when those lease shares are offered. If there's somebody else that wants to lease those at the rate that's being offered by the water district, any tie goes to Paradise Canyon. That's what they held as a right to first refusal. However, the district court construed the lease as a right to renew and a right to renew in perpetuity.
Thank you. So what does that on a perpetual basis language mean, though? Because if it's just the right to first refusal, then why would that perpetual basis language be in there? Why would that be necessary?
It would be, Your Honor, again, that they hold the right, kind of the first in line on a perpetual basis going forward. That if once the water district, if it set the new lease rate, which it did in this case at $1,115, if Southern Nevada Authority comes in and says, we'll pay that for those waters. If Paradise Canyon steps up and says, well, no, we'll pay that.
How is that different than a perpetual right to renew the lease?
Because if there's a perpetual right to renew, the water district will lose all vestiges of ownership. We would have a district court setting the water rate and Paradise Canyon effectively owning the water in perpetuity. The water district is entrusted and needs the ability to allocate its waters for different uses at different times.
But we can't take that, Mr. Reynolds, we can't take that phrase out of the whole contract. It's 155 shares. and they have a right of refusal for 155 shares going forward at a price determined in your client's sole and absolute discretion. Is that correct?
Yes.
That's what the contract says. And the contract, did the court, how did the court's instructions affect the jury's ability to hold that?
We believe that given the court's instructions on its pretrial rulings, the jury was almost compelled to find the way that it did. And it utterly impeded and gutted our ability to present our case in our defense. And I would like to reserve the remaining time. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Jeffrey Sylvester, and I, along with my law partner, Matthew Nealand, here today represent the respondent, Paradise Canyon, LLC. This court's decision in A.C. Shaw stands for the unremarkable proposition that the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing applies to all contracts, including contracts entered into with the government. Told otherwise, to suggest that the government's discretion could not be tempered by the covenant would mean that every contract in which the government entered into where it reserved the discretion to perform would be illusory. The district court held that the rate setting or Paradise Virgin Valley Water District's discretion to set the rate was and is tempered by the covenant of good faith and fair dealing and has to be exercised consistent with the justified expectations of Paradise Canyon. That's the law applying ordinary contract principles. It was the jury that determined that Paradise Canyon's expectations that the rate would be set without reference to and to the exclusion of SMWA lease rate was justified and that it was reasonable.
But counsel, the 2011 contract, well, strike that. Prior to 2011, both contracts had this in and about the Mesquite area for pricing. That was not in the 2011 contract. And the 2011 contract used words like under no circumstances, whatever. Basically, you have a right of first refusal as to 155 shares at the rate in our sole discretion. They notified you about 3 years before the 2020, the time frame. So within the existing contract, how did they violate the good faith and fair dealing covenant?
So to your point, yes, the 2005 and 2007 lease agreements indicated that the lease rate would be set consistent with the rates in and around the area. In determining the justified expectations of the parties pursuant to the Hilton Hotel case, the jury considered all of the prior negotiations, the transactions, and the facts and circumstances included the negotiation that led to the execution of the lease.
But why doesn't the contract control here?
It does.
This feels so much outside of the contract, especially where the language is expressly taken out and the judge expressly puts it back in. Why would your client expect something that was taken out of the contract to be reinserted?
If I understand your question correctly, I think the answer is that the sole and absolute discretion remains. It is still a term of the contract. It is, however, tempered by the expectations of the parties.
That temper was not included in the go forward.
It
was taken out. So 2011 said after 2020, it didn't have that Mesquite area tempering.
That's true.
The judge put that back in.
The judge applied Nevada law that is applicable to the government, that says you have to perform your discretion consistent with the expectations. And so what the jury heard was, what were the expectations, and if they were such that they wouldn't be set pursuant to the SMWA lease rate, why is that reasonable? And the answer is the history of the leasing of those irrigation shares prior to the execution, and it included the discussions with the then general manager and the board as a whole who sat and listened to the negotiation as they occurred in real time. There was, at the time the lease was executed, in 2011, a written policy that the water district would not lease its shares to SMWA. And so that was the expectation consistent with the negotiations wherein Ken Rock, the general manager, indicated that it was outside the realm of possibilities that the rate would be reset in 2020 consistent with the SNWA rate. All the district court did was simply apply the law applicable to the limitation on discretion that has to exist. Otherwise, it would become illusory. That's what the law on the exercise of discretion means. So on the date the expectations were formed is the date the contract was entered into. From that point forward, they had the right and reserved the right through today's date to set that rate. But it's tempered. What were the expectations? That it would be a local market rate. And that...
Okay, that's fine.
Mr. Sylvester, what is the basis in Nevada law for the jury instruction, you are not bound by the express terms of the contract, but are free to go beyond the literal wordage of the written document in making your determination?
Hilton Hotels. And specifically, that was the instruction that was given that the court affirmed. The Hilton Hotels decision indicated, and one of the questions that the Supreme Court had to discuss was whether or not that instruction was appropriate. And the instruction given was that you can go beyond the four corners of the document and consider prior negotiations, prior transactions. That's what the Hilton Hotel stated. One of the arguments that was made to the district court is that, well, there's an integration clause. And because there's an integration clause, you can't have an implied covenant. To accept that as true would be to eviscerate the implied covenant. If you couldn't look to parole evidence to determine the justified expectations of the parties, there would be no such thing as an implied covenant. There would be no way to establish the reasonable expectations if you couldn't go beyond the four corners of the contract. We cited this court to the parole, to the contract second, I'm sorry, the restatement of contract second, all stand for that proposition that you must look at the parole evidence to determine the expectations of the parties. And that's clearly Nevada law. One of the arguments that the appellant stands on is that this court doesn't have jurisdiction because they were somehow exercising a sovereign power. There is no specifically delegated sovereign power that the water district is required to adhere to. Under the terms of the Enabling Act, there is no requirement that they provide irrigation water or that they provide the leasing of irrigation shares.
So, counsel, if we set that aside and we're just viewing this as a street contract case, there are a few things I want you to address on the tone and tenor of the trial. Three things. One, the use of blitzkrieg and opening and referring to them as the government, having that kind of visual display. Two, the admission of a 24 to 28 page findings of fact that were, I think at a casual read, very inflammatory. And I can't remember number three, but I think it'll come back to me.
It'll come to you as I go through the first two. As it relates to the issue of blitzkrieg, just so the court is clear, blitzkrieg means lightning war. That is a little interpretation of that. It is an overwhelming show of force. It is a military tactic. It finds its way into popular culture in media blitz, in the football term of blitz. That's what happened in this case. In 2017, there was an overwhelming show of force and superiority. They attempted to rescind the lease based upon what we claim are manufactured claims of breach, failure to use effluent water, the idea that we were somehow subleasing those shares to SNWA. The visual, which had no reference to, there was no swastikas, there was no reference to Nazis or the Holocaust, unlike the case cited by the appellant, it was of no moment that there were this on the screen, at least in the presentation that I made with respect to the Nazis or Germany or the Holocaust. It is the derivation of the term blitzkrieg. I will note there was no objection during the course of the opening statement, and opposing counsel in his opening statement used the term five times and specifically asked the jury to reflect upon the imagery of the slide and asked the jury rhetorically, what did that intend to denote, which is not at all what the purpose of that was. It was to demonstrate the fact that they were, in fact, showing an overwhelming force to try to claw back 45 shares of the irrigation company. The second question was the admission of the evidence. One, those 25 pages were the result of lengthy summary judgment hearings, contested. They were the facts that the court found were not genuinely disputed. The motion in limine to deem those facts established for trial took place 8 months prior to the trial. They had an extraordinary amount of due process to vet those facts, to your point, remove that language that they thought was inflammatory or somehow prejudicial.
Sorry, the document to be presented to the jury is very different than a court order coming down on summary judgment that was provided, as I understand, 4 days before the jury trial, a 24, 25-page document, which on my read was objected to. I really want you to talk about the language in it. How does that qualify as I just haven't seen anything quite like that.
2 points.
It's a paraphrase, like they did a lot of motions. We won all of them. Like, that's not the kind of fact that goes to the jury. The kind of fact that goes to the jury is, you know, the eyes are blue. Not they said they were green and the judge agreed with us, they're blue. So I really, use of apparently, like, there's a lot of it. The language in there is odd.
And I appreciate that, Justice Stiglitz. The authority comes from 56G. It allows the court to deem facts established conclusively before the balance of the case. That's what the court found. Those factual statements were derived from the five separate and distinct summary judgment motions. You suggest that perhaps some of that language was prejudicial or inflammatory. The process that the court employed was go through these findings of fact and to both sides and tell us what language you find prejudicial, discriminatory, inflammatory, and delete that language. And the record reflected the judge did the same thing. He took those findings of fact that we were required to condense, because they were greater than that amount, to condense and gave both sides the opportunity to go through those and remove those facts that they thought were genuinely disputed, which they weren't, or somehow shouldn't have gone to the jury in the manner in which they did, that the language employed was prejudicial. And they refused to do so. They just simply didn't do it. To your question, the case was about the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing and market value. The issue was not affluent or beneficial use or sublease, but that factual basis that gave rise to those summary judgment motions was not disputed at the time the court entered these findings of fact and conclusions of law. Not one time did they seek competing orders or file competing orders in connection with those five different summary judgment motions. They filed two motions for reconsideration, both which led to findings of fact and conclusions of law, once again submitting no competing order, not challenging on the motion for reconsideration any of the facts that were alleged. And even to today, through today's date, they don't tell this court what facts were prejudicial, which facts shouldn't have gone to the jury to allow them to contemplate the claim of the breach of the implied covenant. Not one. What they say in their opening brief is, well, there's a couple of things, three or four. For instance, they said the term waived was used, or shifted the position, or changed their position. Those are all facts that are undisputed. That's not language that was manufactured. That was the facts of the case. With respect to the term shifted, the government conceded it shifted its position. It started with one when they filed the lawsuit, found out that was wrong, and changed the analysis. That's a fact. From a harmless error standpoint, it is for the appellant to come forward and say these facts shouldn't have gone to the jury. The province of the jury was invaded by submitting these facts on these claims.
I remembered number three, and if I don't say it now, I'll probably forget it again. The timer, bringing in a timer at the end after Paradise's case in chief, bringing in a timer. How do you think that affected the trial?
I don't think it did. The as we put forth in the reply brief or the opening brief, the court determined that both parties had equal floor time. And the court had told the parties at the inception of the case, following the opening statements, that they had committed to 3 weeks of a jury trial. Throughout the process of the case, the court kept emphasizing the fact that you're taking too much time, directed those comments to the appellant outside the presence of the jury. You need to be more efficient with your time. We made a commitment to the jury that it was going to be a three-week trial. We went into 5 weeks. And at some point he said, I've got to put time limitations on this because you're not using your time effectively or efficiently.
But the point at which he decided to put time was after your case was done and their case was starting. Now, can you appreciate the effect that may have on a jury?
In a sense, I can, from a compressed timing standpoint, I think they're probably pleased the fact that this was no longer dragging out for an additional 2 weeks. But again, you have to make a proffer. They say that they had additional witnesses they wanted to call, but they didn't tell the court what witnesses they wanted to call that hadn't been called and what their testimony would have been. That proffer is upon the appellant to make. Otherwise, the district court can't cure the error. But I will say, as we pointed out in the opening brief, we called 10 witnesses, 6 of which they took on cross-examination, 3 of which were cross-examined by the appellant's lead counsel for more than 7 hours. That is an extraordinary amount of fair time to both sides. I didn't limit the examination on cross to the scope of the direct. They had as much time as they wanted and took. And that 7 hours related to the cross-examination of the manager, Ken Rock, and to my client and the general manager, all deriving or trying to get to the issue of justified expectations. So the idea that somehow they weren't afforded due process because they didn't have sufficient time, when they called 19 witnesses by either in cross-examination or on deposition or live testimony, and they couldn't tell the district court one witness that they wanted to call and proffer what that testimony would be to allow him to fix it. And they don't tell you that today. There's no evidence that they were denied due process because this particular witness with this particular testimony didn't testify. And you can't go back and second guess. The idea that, well, we filed the pretrial memorandum and that is sufficient, the court should have known what those testimonies would have been, to use the phrase that Judge Williams stated, that judges aren't blind pigs searching for truffles. You've got to tell the district court what the issue is. You have to make a proffer, and you have to demonstrate how that failure to permit that testimony substantially affected your rights, and they failed to do so. There was a fair trial, they were afforded due process, and we'd ask this court simply affirm.
Thank you.
Joe Reynolds, for the record. Your Honors, with respect to the 24-page order that was entitled Established Facts for Trial, the Water District sought an emergency writ petition with this court on the eve of trial that we were so concerned about that order. In that order, and I would note that it is file-stamped, it has the district court's heading, a pleading, it is signed by the judge, it stated that the Water District shifted factual allegations, that the Water District had no idea about the lease terms, that the Water District waived legal defenses, that the Water District operated under mistaken beliefs, and that the Water District lost claims due to its own inaction. That order also stated that Paradise King's claims were unrefuted, that the district court had repeatedly ruled in Paradise Canyon's favor, and that Paradise Canyon would suffer a, quote, unconscionable loss if the lease were not renewed. The jury was directed that that order and those determinations were binding upon it. Paradise Canyon also argued and referred to this order repeatedly in its closing arguments, and there was also a jury instruction regarding this order. Our argument is that those statements were so highly prejudicial, inflammatory, irrelevant, in hearsay, that it is almost it's unprecedented that I've ever seen an order such like this is admitted to a jury as substantive material evidence that they're directed to consider. I'd also note that the order name-checked the Water District's lead counsel multiple times and asserted that he was responsible for the litigation. If for no other reason, this case should be reversed on the basis of that order alone.
Counsel indicated that the Blitzkrieg reference and the video that accompanied that was unobjected to. There was no objection when that was proffered?
Not in the middle of the opening statement. The objection and a motion for a mistrial was made at the first break when the jury was out of the courtroom. And the mistrial motion was made not only on the basis of the slide images on the Blitzkrieg, Nazi references and imagery, but also that Paradise Canyon showed copies of district court orders granting summary judgment in its favor, that the that Paradise Canyon also invoked the Water District's lead counsel as a witness, blamed him again and name-checked him repeatedly as causing this litigation, in that he drafted the lease in issue, and that it was on all those reasons that we moved for mistrial at the first break when the jury didn't hear those arguments. With respect to Paradise Canyon's argument that the subjective expectations of one party to a contract should control the interpretation in the plain language of the contract, we ask this court to reject that premise. That is contrary to bedrock contract law. Justified expectations of a party to a contract must be governed by the plain language of the contract. The implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing can't be weaponized to change or alter negotiated terms. The justified expectations for Paradise Canyon in this case was that the new rate would be set by the board in its sole and absolute discretion. That's what the contract said. That's what justified expectations said. Instead, what they're asking this court to embrace is that when one party of a contract wants to say, we wanted a rate or we expected a rate to be something other than it was set, that that expectation bends the language of the contract. It does not, and it should not. Our position is not that the covenant of good faith and fair dealing doesn't apply in all contracts. It does, but it doesn't and can't be used to subvert the plain language itself. With respect also to the court's questions regarding the conduct of the trial itself, the digital clocks were placed, as Justice Stiglitz noted, at the beginning of the defense's case in chief. They were not in Paradise Canyon's case in chief. They had 12 days to present their case in chief with no digital clocks. They came in only at ours. Thank you, and we ask this court to reverse and remand.
Okay, colleagues, any additional questions?
No.
Okay, thank you for the arguments today.